Lovely.
This is us live on Radio Edutalk. Radio Edutalk is an internet radio station and podcast all about many different aspects of education. My name's John Johnson and I'm sitting in Glasgow, and I'm really pleased to be joined by Frances Bell, who is in Macclesfield. Good evening, Frances.
Good evening, John. It's great to be with you.
Thank you for applying to be on the show. I think you've probably given us one of the best set of notes for show notes than we've had for a long time. So I'm really interested in the fascinating ride. I think physically bumped into you at OER16.
That's right. Yeah.
And our title for tonight is Informal Learning and Research in and Out of the Academy. And we'll maybe get to that in a minute, but I wonder, could you just give us a sort of elevator pitch of your background, Frances?
Yeah. Well, I graduated in 1974 with a maths degree in the middle of a recession. So you had to sort of get whatever job was going. And I fell into a job as a programmer and then an analyst. And I really enjoyed programming. I think I was quite good at it. But I then realized it wasn't much of a job in the 70s if you wanted to have a child. So I moved into education, first secondary, and then I taught in FE and adult education, full-time and part-time. And then eventually I ended up at Teesside Polytechnic and then eventually at Salford University, but most of my career was in higher education.
You're now retired.
I retired in 2013, yeah.
Although it's reasonably hard to believe from looking at your blog, and you're still, I guess, involved in various aspects of education, and including this idea of informal education, and working with older people as well, which I think is interesting. And just to sort of kick us off, could you maybe just speak a wee bit about this idea of informal learning? And you've worked mostly in further education, which I presume is formal.
In higher education, mainly, yeah. I only worked for a couple of years in further education, but No, I mean, what I think is interesting, and that's perhaps one of the benefits of having an old fogey like me, is that people who are a bit younger than me might tend to associate informal education with the internet, but I think it's really important to look historically at informal learning, you know, look at some of the stuff that's gone on. So in my own life, I mean, if you think about, I'll start with one of the resources that I've shared, which is the site infed.org, which is a really good site to learn more about informal education. And they say about themselves, we specialise in the theory and practice of informal education, social pedagogy, lifelong learning, social action, and community learning and development. And I think it's really important to think about learning not just within the context of formal education. And yet, I also think that informal education, it's very important to think about how we might influence students in their informal learning without necessarily observing it. I don't know if that makes sense.
So you think even for students, and hopefully we're including school-age pupils, that we should be, as a influence, you should be having some effect on their informal learning, although we're not going to measure it or...
But also, because they'll be doing it anyway, some of them, particularly if it's a hobby or whatever, they will be engaging in informal learning, some of which will be on the internet. And I believe this very strongly from when I began my career in education, is that if we can draw on the contexts of learning, even ones we don't observe, you know, things that, because that might be where they've got very, very strong interests. They might love to learn cartooning or whatever, that can actually help them draw on that experience for their learning within formal education.
And I'm just thinking of my own teaching at the moment. I've got a few kids in my class who are fascinated by insects. And you know, they turn up at school with something strange in their hands in the morning, and we've been able to sort of leverage that into the classroom and you know, do a bit of writing about it and a bit of research and all the rest of it. And is that the sort of thing you mean, or do you mean something that's even sort of less connected with what we're learning?
Well, I think it's very difficult for all of us, and particularly young people, to reflect on how they learn something or what it means. So, for example, if you taught computing, as I did in the 1980s, you were teaching students, I was teaching A-level students in an FE college at one point, you were teaching them about billing systems or, you know, bank accounts or electricity billing, whatever, and they didn't really understand, it wasn't really part of their lives, whereas if there's something which is has some meaning for them, is important to them, then I think they're more likely to pay attention to it and to be able to reflect on it. And that might, how they learn to do that thing, well, they might be able to transfer that to how they learn to do their A-levels or their degree or, you know, whatever it is.
So, I mean, again, just talking about this idea of my class, because it's easy for me to think about that. I'm beginning to think that when I'm talking to them about the things they're learning out of school, we should be emphasising that they are learning.
Yes.
And saying, you know, this is you're learning and you're being a good learner. So that they kind of know what that feels like.
And it can be fun.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like necessarily somebody making you do something. It can be something that's completely self-driven.
And also it's very concrete and it's not abstract. You know, the trouble with formal education is we can easily slip into teaching, you know, and I taught maths for a year or two, into teaching the abstract, whereas actually we all prefer, well, not maybe all of us, but many of us prefer concrete things.
So you do the concrete learning and then you can abstract that. The idea is a bit more mature in your head and things,
and also to think about how you learn something, which I think is interesting. For example, as a learner myself now, one of the things that I'm really interested, I can give you an example, which is always a good thing, because I've got more time. I've always been interested in craft activities, but I've got much more time now, and I've spent a lot of time learning about quilting. So today I was at a class where I was so it was quite social. There was a group of us there. I was actually doing something that the teacher wasn't particularly good at, which is free motion quilting, which is a bit like drawing with a sewing machine. And that's very much what I'm doing at the minute. I know it's not, it doesn't look like it does in the book. It's still quite flaky and not very good, but I'm perfectly satisfied with it because it's almost, it's what they call muscle memory, muscle learning. You have to learn to do it as a thing. You know, you can't think about it, a bit like riding a bike or something. You've just got to do it, and the more you do it, the better you get at it. So, you know, I've sort of lost my way a bit here. So I can watch videos that helps teach me a bit about this sort of quilting. I can listen to things, I can read books, but mainly I have to just do it.
Yeah, you're learning by doing. And one of the things you say, you're learning with a group of people.
Yeah.
And there's a social aspect to that then. And is it that other people are saying, oh, this is how you do this, or is it just that you're in a comfortable place, I guess, while you're learning because you're with other people?
Yeah, it's well, we share experiences. The teacher in the class we go to has had quite a lot of time off because she's had cancer and she's had chemotherapy, and she lets us come to the class even that when she isn't there, we just pay less to attend. And so we've had to very much be self-help and teaching each other and learning from each other, and that's actually been really good at melding the group together. You know, we're a much stronger group, and the teacher's slid back into it now, and that's fine. She's quite comfortable with that. And I also attend the University of the Third Age, which is all about social learning. It's not about having a teacher. It's about people might do the odd talk, but they just, you know, learn in a social setting most of the time. And it's really great. And I think there's a lot for formal education to learn from some of these things. And I know a lot of people have already learnt that. And I shared a blog post that I did, which was actually it was actually an article for LifeWide Learning, which is by Norman. I'll remember his name in a bit. But because it was so difficult to actually, it wasn't very web friendly. It was buried deep in a PDF. So I've copied it onto my blog, a blog post, but it's there, and it's looking at Ravelry, which is a knitting and crochet site. And my subject discipline in when I was teaching was information systems, so I'm really interested in things like design and so on. And I tell you that apparently it's a worldwide thing, Ravelry.com. It's financed, well, I tell you in the article how it's financed. I think there are only 5 employees worldwide. Well, you know, when I think about some of the virtual learning environments that I've worked with, they haven't a clue compared with Ravelry.com. You know, they could learn so much from seeing what happens with good community and social learning online.
And I was just wondering how you could actually leverage that into formal education, because it very much relies on people's own enthusiasm and following, I guess, what they're interested in.
Well, I think that is true, and it's because they've got that passionate interest, which obviously helps. But if you look at the architecture of the Ravelry site and compare it with the architecture of say, most of the virtual learning environments I looked at, you know, I worked with, there's just no comparison. And it's just organized around really sensible things like projects and resources and chatting. And the linkage between them is really easy. And it isn't as aggressive as a lot of the social media sites that we get, which are about sucking in the content for their purposes for advertising. It's just much more elegant. It's hard to describe if you haven't used it, really. But anyway, I do try to describe it in the article. So.
Yeah, so it's a good blog post on that one. Interestingly, I had a guest a while ago, Steve Beard, who's an educationalist down south who teaches computing across school-age children. And for a while, he was attempting to teach knitting to children in computing clubs.
Oh, I think I've seen a talk by him, right, yeah.
Sort of links.
I was knitting during the talk, actually.
Yeah. So there's quite a wide range of interests you've got, and maybe we could just touch on this subtitle to your blog, which is Frances Bell, but the subtitle is Home at Last for All the Me's.
Oh yes, that was funny. I mean, I think people struggle with how to do their identity, to, you know, who they should be and how they should be online, particularly if they have a sort of professional setting. You know, they've got a professional role, you have to think about that. I mean, when I was working, I used to think that I would, when I was on Twitter, I would try to think that the Vice Chancellor might be looking over my shoulder while I was tweeting. So he didn't have to agree with what I was saying. But, you know, I didn't particularly want to tweet anything that would cause massive ructions or whatever. So I just tried to do that. And it's great when you retire because you don't even have to think about the Vice Chancellor looking at your tweets anymore, if he ever did. And so I was conscious that I wanted to have the balance of my activities was changing between education, research, and, you know, my own personal interests and activities like crafts and so on. But I wanted a place where I could have all of them in the one place. So, and I consulted lots of people. I blogged about it and got loads of comments, and that really helped me. And so that's what I've done. So if you look at it, I've got things I make, as you know, on my I'll just bring it up and then I can see it. So I've got making and doing. I've got a section called making and doing, which has got knitting, research, recipe, I think there's only one of those, our garden, which is photos of the garden, and then one single page which is called Macclesfield Getting Started Internet Resources. So not very good structure there, but maybe I'll revisit it sometime. And that relates to my deciding that what I wanted to do was to use some of my time to do practical things, volunteer in my local community. And so that's been a really interesting aspect of my life over the last 6 months to a year. So, yeah.
I love that idea of, you know, making and doing, including knitting and research, which is formal, you know, hard to read academic research, and recipes in your garden and this other stuff. I think that's really nice. And I kind of, this idea of, you know, you're thinking your chancellor looking over your shoulders, and I guess your students as an educator. When I recently sort of came back into the classroom after doing support for a few years, and I was quite surprised that, if it shouldn't have been, that I heard on the grapevine that several of the parents of the children I was teaching had checked out my blog. And that then made me rethink exactly what I do. I mean, I've always been very aware that as a teacher, I need to, you know that children will see what you do and things like that. But thinking about how parents of children you're teaching are thinking about it is another interesting aspect of being online. And many of us, I think, do split up what you've brought back together here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's quite interesting. I, like many of us, I've got many teachers in my circle of family and friends, and I noticed, I think it must have been some directive, hopefully not from Gove at the time, that they now don't use their surnames on their Facebook accounts. And really, I wonder, you know, so they somehow, you know, use their first name and some adaptation. And I really wonder who they're kidding if they think that parents aren't going to find one way or another bits of what they say on Facebook, you know. So,
yeah, yeah.
And that actually relates to some of the work that I've, some of the research that I've done. I've done some work, little bits of work about context collapse. And, you know, I think that's just a fact, really. And the more social media platforms are trying to get us to share. I mean, think of your Twitter. Do you use Twitter on a smartphone, John?
Yes, I do.
Have you noticed the difference between using it on your smartphone and using it on the desktop? Well, I use TweetDeck on the desktop. That, in case you missed it. Have you noticed that? And it isn't on the desktop. It isn't on my desktop.
Well, more and more, I think Twitter is throwing you things that you haven't asked for. And I've certainly got my settings on my phone set to, you know, don't use any algorithm to decide what I want to see. But I've noticed I get notifications about, you know, these two people are talking about this.
Yeah, exactly. And what do you think they're using to choose what they show you, an algorithm, you know?
Well, it'd be some sort of machine. You know, some sort of machine will be doing that, and the point of that machine, I guess, is to make money for Twitter in whichever way it makes money. And I think the space is getting more complicated as we go.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think your research is dipping into or touching on is, I guess, a wee bit of pushback against the mad enthusiasm for the new and shiny and communicative. And because, I mean, one of the things you maybe touch on here is when you started putting resources online, which was very early on, I guess, on the internet.
Yeah.
And this post you've got opened by accident. But I'm very interested in just even the difference when I started working with children online in, say, 1999, 2000, and now it feels a very different place. But I wonder, could you maybe talk a wee bit about...
Yeah, I could. I mean, to tell the story, I think it was probably late 1996 or early 1997 that a colleague, I worked in a computer science department, and so there was a computer science colleague who had a Lotus Notes server under his desk, I think it was, in his room, and he wrote a little student information system, so everybody, all the teachers and, I don't know if the students, yeah, all the teachers and students in the department would have a Lotus Notes account. So, you know, we already had that access. And then I discovered that there were these, what they called database templates. So one of them was a Microsoft Office template, and another one was a sort of, I don't know what it called, like a discussion template. And the what I discovered was that if I used the Microsoft Office template and I just added, say, my PowerPoints or notes in Word, they were available on the internet when Lotus had this version of their server called the Domino server, which it sort of on the fly interpreted the database. It had the most horrendous URLs you've ever seen in your life, but on the fly, so effectively you had this really simple way of publishing material, but also setting up spaces for student discussion, which you could control. So, you know, it was within the group, you know, it was a sort of semi-private discussion. So I suddenly could do this, whereas I thought I'd have to learn HTML and persuade the IT department to give us a tilde space on a server. Mm. So, you know, it just sort of happened, really. And, you know, I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And then, of course, the university, as it always does, reorganized around me, and I was in a different department, and I no longer had access to the Lotus Notes server. So I was forced to learn HTML in 4 weeks. So.
There was less HTML in those days, though.
Yeah, it wasn't good HTML, John.
So that experience, I'm interested first, one of the things is that the first publishing that you did was not on a sort of official space. And I think we kind of see iterations of that going on with people trying new things out, and then that becomes absorbed or changed by institutions or whatever.
Yeah. Well, it's before we got Blackboard. Mm. In fact, because I was I got involved with Lotus Notes and they were trying to get into universities, I did get invited onto a project where I could use, people won't have heard of it now, but it was called Lotus Learning Space. So it was a sort of virtual environment, and it was infinitely superior to Blackboard as it was then, or even as it is now, I would imagine. It just had a much better architecture. And so, it's just interesting, really, that, I don't know. I despair of some of the ways that software systems are developed. And it's no wonder people have fallen into using Google and Facebook as alternatives to institutional systems, really. You know, it's not surprising at all. So, yeah, but not necessarily a good thing.
So if it's not necessarily a good thing, Is there a good thing?
No, you just have to do the best you can, yeah. I think. But I think that we could look to companies that develop software and university IT departments who provide it to think, well, why aren't you looking at the good, you know, the good ways that people are, you know, that was why I wrote the article about Ravelry. Who has anybody ever actually looked at that and thought, what has this got to tell us about how people learn? You know, so I don't know.
And I guess, yeah, learning by getting good practice of learning that's maybe not institutionalised in this case, or I saw a fascinating thing on the internet, it was kind of very widely spread a while ago, about how fan fiction people who wrote fan fiction used a delicious bookmarking service. They developed this structure so that they could all communicate and share links in a very sort of structured way, using delicious links by the tags they picked, and they built up their own sort of formal informal taxonomy.
I think they called it a folksonomy, don't they? When it's a taxonomy that's developed within a community by their practice. Yeah. And then, of course, Delicious completely changed, because that's what social media do, isn't it?
Yeah, it did. But again, what's interesting about that is that the guy that does the pinboard service picked that up, and he supports it, and he got a huge bunch of users who came across because he decided to support that. That was interesting to me. Maybe straying off into the... I'm away on pinboard already, so that's a bit far off. But sort of connected to that, you have done some work, we're saying, you know, maybe Facebook or Google are not the best things to use in education. But you have kind of done some research around maybe the less... I was going to say expected, but the less positive aspects of using of social learning online.
Yeah,
and I wonder if you just say a few words about that, maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did some research with Jenny Magnus and Mariana Funes on our participation in the RISO 14 course, and that was really interesting. And as part of that. And this has been one of the things I personally had to learn, was very much that we got data, qualitative data from the participants, and worked with that and used our participant observation. But also, I managed, way after the course had finished, I tried several times while it was going on, to get data from Facebook, from the Facebook group. And that was really, really interesting to see... what the interactions felt like when you were watching a Facebook group, and what the data was that you only obviously get a subset of the data from the application programming interface of Facebook, and Facebook controls what you get. But it was really interesting to compare that, because you sort of felt as if you're getting a peek into the data that Facebook stores in order to feed its algorithms, in order to manipulate your experience. So, well, we didn't have anything hugely definite because we didn't have full access to the data. But I found that was really, really interesting, and it has influenced some of the approaches I take now, although it's not research that I'd want to reproduce, really, ad infinitum. And I suppose the biggest impact that it had on me was to be much more reflective about the sort of... So thinking about our experience on social media and reflecting on our own experiences on different platforms, but also on the same platform on different apps or on the desktop and on different devices. So... I think it can be quite useful. I did some of this for my OER 17 presentation, where I reflected on my Facebook experience on the desktop. And as a result of that, I deleted the Facebook app from my smartphone. and that in turn has affected my experience on Facebook. So I'm not proving anything, I'm just observing what happens if I tweak things. And I think that could be quite a useful approach if we did it in groups and shared our experiences. I don't know if that made sense, really.
I think it's something we've talked about on the radio before, the idea of the sort of affordances of different types of software. And you know, just basically ones that give you notifications, say, or how it organises the information for you, and how that affects, you know, all sorts of things. How it affects, I guess, the importance you give to things and how involved you become. And I guess something like Facebook, I've got a Facebook account, but I don't really spend a lot of time on there. But and Twitter, I guess, as well, are trying to keep you engaged more than anything else, I guess.
Yes.
And that might not be the best thing for your learning.
Well, I think it's very interesting, because if you've got an app on your smartphone or your tablets, it's very difficult to actually log out of it. You can shut the window, but you're not necessarily logged out. And I find that presents difficulties for me, because a lot of the people who come to book appointments with me as an IT buddy in the library might be using a smartphone or a tablet or a laptop, but you know, they don't want to learn on the library computer. They want to use the device that they have with them. And I think that really, because so many people new to digital and the internet are coming via apps and portable devices, they're actually, it's easier for the platforms to suck more data out of their experience than it is on a desktop.
And I guess it's easier for the platforms to shape their experience on mobile. I mean, it does worry me, you know, as a teacher of small kids, that there's a lot of basics that children don't necessarily get if they're using tablets and even just sophisticated applications. You know, I think there's a great deal to be said to learn to, you know, to use Paint, for instance. To use, you know, an application which I would normally dislike but find really useful for teaching, because it actually teaches you something about how these things start to work, how bitmaps work and things like that. That if you use a smartphone app or a tablet app, you have no idea about what you're doing, really.
Ease of use comes at a price, doesn't it?
It's just, maybe we shouldn't at any stage of education lose complete sight of the metal underneath.
No.
I'm not saying
it's how to engage with that and how to achieve some sort of working understanding of that, particularly when it's changing all the time.
Even writing notes for applications or web pages now. I did a few years' work supporting IT centrally in a local authority here, and you would just watch these things go out of date as fast as you typed. I remember going out with a colleague and we were using Microsoft 365, and she'd been up on Friday night or Sunday night before the Monday morning we got out, updating notes and writing notes, and went into a classroom and working with a bunch of children. And she gave the teacher the notes saying, can you follow on and check if I've made any mistakes? And she said, it just looks completely different. Because it was an internet site and somebody's changed something. So I think that points to the fact that giving people notes is probably not a great idea anymore.
I suppose that the stuff I've been thinking about over the last 6 to 12 months. And it's a lot of people, obviously lots of people are interested in this. We all sort of get, I think, that our agency is shared between us as human beings and technology and other things. But how do we respond to the idea that if humans can't have absolute control over technology and platforms, what can we do seems like a good question, because I sometimes think people just shrug their shoulders. Some people just shrug their shoulders and think, oh, we can't do anything. And so some of the ideas that I've been playing with at OER 17 was the idea of digital trespass. So I use the idea of the Kinder Scout trespass, where the Duke of Devonshire, whoever it was, had all this land in Derbyshire that was, people weren't allowed to use it, and they just the working people came and did this trespass where they reclaimed Kinder Scout, and obviously got thrown into jail. But so the idea that we can actually trespass against digital is sort of an intriguing idea for me. And then at Alt-C, I looked at the idea that resistance to technology, which doesn't have to be negative, how about we see that as a digital literacy?
A digital literacy would be to maybe decide that we're not using digital for something particular,
or to believe, which is, I don't think we can control these huge multinational megacorps, but we can. But resistance doesn't have to be futile. So, look at what happened with Uber in London. Obviously, it'll, move on from there and be something different. So resistance can be something that doesn't control a megacorp, but could shape what it does. Does that make any sense?
I mean, the London one, I guess, was the government or, the City of London doing it. And I'm interested in how, in a practical sense, say you would become a trespasser.
Yeah, well, I mean, it isn't just one thing. That's one facet of it, and that can change as it goes on. I'm sure London will probably come to some arrangement with them and whatever. But it's all part of, that whole Uber thing was all part of, people complaining about being attacked by drivers, and what happens when you have deregulation. It's not that nobody's ever been, no woman has ever been raped, as a result of a black cab. But I don't know if that's true even. But you're much less likely to have a problem than you are with an unregulated service like Uber or whatever. Some mini cabs would be, there'd be more incidences of attacks than with the black cabs and so on. So it's not about you can control it. And then the whole Uber thing was, there was all the women who complained about what it was like to work there and so on. So it's not just one thing of Transport for London saying they can't get their license unless they comply with this, that and the other. It's actually an amalgamation of lots of things. Resistance sort of can gain a critical mass if lots of people are doing it and not always succeeding absolutely where they do it.
Yeah, so a tide?
A state of mind, really.
Yeah.
We don't have to. So if you think about technology that resistance is futile, well, that's what you'll get. You'll get exactly what those those megacorps want.
Well, let's hope not on that one. And just these sort of ideas. At the moment, you're working with older people. Is it through the libraries to look at?
Yes, I think a lot of libraries have this scheme. It's called an IT buddy. So it's advertised. I only do 3 hours a week at the moment, and people can have a one-to-one. They pay £2. That's really just to discourage them from not turning up, I think. And I volunteer. I'm not paid to do it. and I get supported by the librarians, and so I help people with whatever they want to be helped with when they come in, or do my best to help them. And what's been interesting, I was interested in this anyway, but it has been a bit of an eye-opener. So one of the first things I came across was that in my town, local town, a sort of service for matching social housing clients with properties, which was run across different, sponsored by the council, but run across different housing associations, went completely online from the 7th of July. So, whereas before that, if people wanted to do it and they couldn't do it, you know, instead of being offered online as an option, if they couldn't do it, they could go into an office in the council, but presumably because of the budget cuts, they've shut that office, and the only way you can do it is online. So imagine you're an elderly, possibly disabled person who's never, hasn't got a computer, has never used a computer. They have to come in to somebody like me and try to learn how to use the computer. And then once they've, you know, I could help them, be a proxy user for them, but that doesn't work. They could bid for property, but then they've got to check their email every few days, because if they're offered a property and they haven't checked their email, the offer will be withdrawn. To me, it was like a sort of I, Daniel Blake moment for me, that.
Yeah, because you're automatically excluding a whole tranche of people. But I was wondering, as you're working with these people, do you get anywhere near the sort of thing you've just been talking about this idea of being aware or resistant or whatever to the technologies? Or
no, and I find it puts me in quite a difficult position. I would say openly to them, like I said to the guy who had to apply for his blue badge, his disability car, you know, his car motor disability badge. You know, I said, I think this is outrageous. I don't think you should have to do this. Yeah. But that's as far as I can go, really. You know, and it took us both nearly an hour to fill in all the information, because halfway through the, this shows how little thought the developers have given to this. Halfway through him filling in the form online, I said, oh, what's your blue badge number? And he said, oh, it's in the car. So this disabled person had to go down in the lift in the library, out to his car in the disabled parking place, get his blue badge and bring it back in. Well, you know, sorry, that's not good enough, is it?
No. So you maybe not proceselling or whatever to these people, but it's fueling a bit of...
sympathising,
righteous indignation or something like that.
I sputter when I get home. I don't sputter too much when I'm with them, so it is interesting though, isn't it? It's a sort of belief that putting everything online is okay and is going to be good for people, whereas actually what it's about is reducing transaction costs for the council.
And I guess the cuts maybe need to do that. I wonder if what sort of differences you're finding working with older people in a sort of informal setting, as to working with younger people in a more formal setting, if there's anything there.
Well, what was interesting, because certainly in the latter years of my teaching, and I'm not a digital native sympathiser, but in the latter years of my teaching, most of the students had grown up completely with these things. In fact, one of my colleagues, who's great, started collecting old technologies from eBay, because we were having 18-year-olds who had very little recollection, and they loved us to get stuff out, like a Walkman or, you know, a brick phone or whatever, because they just didn't have this experience, and it was very useful for them to see how technology had developed over 20 years or whatever. So, you know, I think that's really useful for them to see. But a difference that I noticed most recently, and the more older people I see, the more I can sort of understand their differences, is I had somebody recently who I'm pretty sure was illiterate, and I don't know, I didn't ask him, but that, so that reinforces the inequality of illiteracy. I had somebody who had worked in an office and had keyboard skills and felt that she didn't know how to use a spreadsheet for something, but really she was in a much better position. So it sort of gives you a bit of an understanding of the variable nature of how people are disadvantaged when they're forced to use things online.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's sort of hidden. You know, the folk are developing that, maybe just don't even consider that there'll be people without access at home. If they've got access at home, they're using it for a particular purpose.
Yes.
I certainly notice with children, a lot of them are very au fait with tablets, for instance.
Yeah.
Not typing.
Yes.
You know, even on a tablet, they don't really do that. No. They've learned their pathways, and again, I think this is whether they're digital natives or not. And I think that has been kicked fairly far out of the park.
So in some ways, somebody who was taught touch typing in the 1960s might, in some ways, have an advantage.
Because
it's just a lot more complicated than it seems at first sight, isn't it?
The volunteering, your IT buddy thing, and I say you're basically teaching digital literacy to older people. And the way you do it, how would that differ from a more formal sense, I guess?
Well, it's interesting because I was teaching information systems at undergraduate, and that was most of my teaching apart from this other module that I was talking about more recently. Because I was teaching that over a long period to undergraduates and postgraduates, and with postgraduates you often got people who'd done quite a technical undergraduate program, and they were coming to us, and we were looking at much softer ideas of softer. So I had a module where I used to say to them, the most important thing you will learn from this module is about context. So, you know, don't think that you're learning about technology. You're thinking about learning about technology in different contexts. So the developer who doesn't think about the context in which one of the users uses their website hasn't thought about context, and that's why the problems arise. I mean, it's an oversimplification, but that's my idea. And so if you translate that to my work with when I'm volunteering, I say, when the person sits down with me, I say, what is it that you want to do? And sometimes they just say, you know, something very specific so we can look at that. Or they might say, I just want to be able to use a computer or whatever. And so they don't really know what they want to do. But when you talk to them about what they're interested in, they might be interested in travel or, finding out about art or something like that. So we can actually start from there and think about where are the places on the internet they might like to look. And so then the two most generally useful things are Google and Wikipedia, because that can be a starting point. Or if they told me that they're interested in gardening, I would tell them that the rhs.org site was a really useful site and show them, but try to latch into something that was of interest to them. So I suppose that takes us back to the thing I said at the beginning, doesn't it? It's really about learning from, you know, you said about the kids bringing it, looking at insects when we were talking earlier. You know, it's about what it's about what interests the person who is going to be doing this.
I mean, that's a really elegant loop that we planned there.
Hours of scripting.
Better not start. The sort of, I think, brings us to a circle. I don't know if there's anything else you want to touch on, Frances. I'm realizing.
I think that people can have a look at the links that I've shared, and I think you've given my. I'll post something on the hashtag, so people can see my Twitter ID if they want to contact me.
I think it's on the post, and we'll have the archive of this up on the Edutalk site.
Ian Guest has been live tweeting me.
Yeah, there's a couple of people, and you've got I suspect Caroline in the Shetlands who's been talking. Hello, Caroline is a knitter as well, or certainly will be next door neighbour to a knitter up there. I don't know if she's wearing a Shetland jumper in her Twitter archive or not, but yeah, we'll put the show notes together with your Twitter ID on the podcast, and that should be up in a day or two.
So,
I would recommend if you want some informal and formal learning, people to have a wee look at your blog, which, as I say, just reading that one drop down. When you've got research, knitting and gardening all bumping into each other, gives you a great idea. But the range of your interests, some fascinating stuff, and we've only really scratched on it. There's a lot of interesting things there, but there's a lot of great notes. I certainly will keep following and paying attention, Frances, so thank you very much.
Well, I've really enjoyed it, John. It was really great to sit down and reflect. That was very helpful for me. I always find that useful. And then this conversation has gone in directions I wouldn't have anticipated. So that's great.
We run in serendipity here, I hope.
Yeah. So,
I'm just going to hang up this broadcast now. So I'll say good night to people listening online. Cheers, folks.
Good night.